Penny Penny Arcade. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, hello, and welcome to the Paisley Penny Arcade. I'm Mo, and today is Wednesday, October the 1st of 2025. Hello, hello, and come on in, have a seat. Sit right down, enjoy yourself. It's all in the mind anyway, and it doesn't matter, so it's mind over matter. I know, it's an old joke, what can I say? Less, yeah, though you're thinking, say less, Mo. So how's it going? What's going on? How's everybody doing? I hope you're all doing well. And, you know, you can join me in the YouTube chat. There is listening on 12radio.com, and you can come into the YouTube chat. That's Mo Abdelbaki. Let's see, how is that? YouTube at Mo Abdelbaki. That's MOABDELBAKI. Had to think about it for a second. Let me fix this so you're not looking at my ceiling. There's nothing wrong with my ceiling. It's perfectly okay. So, hi. So, yeah, October, finally. Whew, this year has not exactly been speeding by, but here we are in the 10th month of the year of 2025. Another couple of months and we'll be starting 2026. I don't know about you, but this has been a strange year. Whew-wee. Boy, hasn't it been just. Allergy season seems to be going all year long. It has been one of those, and indeed, I think it could be going a lot longer. So, October, of course, Halloween is coming at the end of the month. I thought I'd do something a little bit different, or maybe I've done this before. I'm at that part in my life where I don't rightly remember exactly. But what I'm going to do is talk about, interestingly, I think, kind of, you know, maybe spooky stuff, interesting stuff. Not scary, because there's nothing scary about it, in my opinion. I'll tell my own ghost story toward the end, probably the show before the end of Halloween. The show before, right before Halloween. How's that? And I'll tell you my ghost story, because I did see a ghost. And I've had kind of a few encounters with such things. I do believe in ghosts. And once you've experienced it, you go, oh, so that's what that is. And you know for sure. That's just the way it is. Yeah. So, would love to have you come in the chat room. Say hi. Mo, what's going on? Ta-ta. And, well, ta-ta, I guess, would be goodbye, wouldn't it? So, you don't have to do that, but you can if you'd like. Yeah, so how are you doing? Strange world we're living in right now. A lot of interesting things going on. Oh, you know what? I actually did not create this. You know what? On the radio, I didn't start on YouTube. Oh my God, this is all so complicated. So I'm gonna do that right now, Yeah, I'm going to do that right now while I'm talking to you. I am going to do that right now. I am. And so you're hearing this live. And yeah. I'm just going to do this right now live. And might as well. And here we go. Yeah, might as well. Okay, and now I'm live in the YouTube thing. The whole beginning is gone. It didn't start. So now people are saying, what's going on? I started the show, and I forgot to start. Forgot to create the show. This is all so new to me. So hello, everybody. It started late. There's no beginning. There will probably be no end. I'll just keep going on. Wow. It's new to me. I forgot to create the show. So this is, we're beginning the show. Luckily, I did it before I was halfway through. So those of you now watching YouTube, you're saying, Mo didn't do a show, but I'm actually doing a show now. So if you want to come back and watch it on YouTube, why would you bother? I'm here. I remembered. So here it is. The show is on. Goodness gracious. There's so much to remember. I did everything else. I did it all, and except for the one thing that I was supposed to do was begin the show on YouTube. So now it's live on YouTube. It is streaming, and there it is. Quelly, how are you? I forgot to create the show on YouTube, so I did everything else. I did the opening. I did it right. Everything was perfect, except for the fact that I didn't create the show. There we are. All right. So, hi. Thank you for persisting and being there. Some people probably came in and said, oh, he's not doing a show today. I did a show. It's on the radio. So those on the radio heard it. And those who, others are going, that old man, he's just really ridiculous. Yes, I am really ridiculous at times, but that's okay. You know, I've always been this way. This is not a function of age. I'm just going to tell you that. This has nothing to do with my age. This has to do with me being me. It's like there are tornadoes in my head all the time. I was telling a friend that today. It's like I have tornadoes in my head. I actually designed my tarot card, my Prince of Air, Prince of Air. Oh, my goodness. My Prince of Swords with tornadoes, because that's, I identify. Renee, hey, how are you? Come into the chat room. Be nice to see you. Come in and talk to me. I'd love to talk to you, especially today, because it's Halloween month. We're going to talk about Dracula. That's right. And the question is, why, of all the stories that have been written about scary stuff, why is Dracula so enduring? Written in 1897 by Bram Stoker. Why? Mighty Mo the Yo-Yo Pray. Oh, Lisa, how are you? Anne, bonjour, Anne. And thank you for the lovely letter, Anne. I will write you back. Yes. A lot to write you about, because I've thought about many of those things. And I actually have answers, so we'll talk. Indeed, I've always been curious as to, if you've ever seen the Dracula movies with Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee, who I think was a great Dracula. Frank Langella played Dracula as well. The question is, why has this story written by Bram Stoker in 1897, published in 1897, he probably did it more than in a few minutes, you know. If you've ever read it, it is a fascinating book to read. It's written all in letters and journals. All in letters and journals. Can be hard to read at times, but it's also a bit xenophobic, I'll say. He makes fun of people's accents at times. That's kind of maybe how it was. We're going to talk about this book, but I think the reason it is so enduring, actually, we'll get to that. But there are reasons for that, and it's fascinating in many, many ways. But I'm going to look at some of these. For example, I'd also like to look at Frankenstein, which is not what you think it was about. Maybe you do know what it's about. It's a book about social reform. Mary Shelley was brilliant, absolutely screamingly brilliant, brilliant, brilliant mind, and incredibly to the point about the woes of mankind, and especially civilized mankind, civilized. But Dracula, Bram Stoker, was born in Dublin, Ireland. Pretty tempestuous, Dublin. He was Anglican, so he was not Catholic. And so there were issues there, of course. And bear with me, I don't have notes. I'm just having to kind of, you know, decide what part of this I want to talk about. But he ended up being a theater manager, the Lyceum Theater in London. And he became kind of the manager for a fellow by the name of Henry Irving. Henry Irving was a famous actor of his time, but the Lyceum Theater put on very dramatic plays. By dramatic, I mean melodramatic plays, you know. And at the time, one of the things that were very popular, one of the genre of media that were very popular, were known as penny dreadfuls. Now, you may have heard of the show Penny Dreadful. If you've not seen it, it was really a hoot. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Renee, hi. So nice to see you in the room. I love that you guys are coming into the room. It makes me feel, you know, like Sally Fields. You like me. You really like me. Tears. I'm serious. I'm sincere. I'm very sincere about that. I love it. I love having the chats. I love talking to you. You can talk to me. I'll talk to you back because it's an interesting process. And it's in real time. I like that part. Except for those of you watching in the future with your space helmets on and, you know, those things. So the whole point about the Penny Dreadfuls is that they were dreadful. I mean, they were about horrible things. And they cost a penny, and they were on pulp paper. The Strand magazine was a little bit above that. And, of course, the most famous character in the Strand magazines was Sherlock Holmes, serialized week after week after week in the Strand magazine. Arthur Conan Doyle wrote in the Strand magazine. And Stoker knew Arthur Conan Doyle. He got to know him once he became famous, of course. His best friend, really, really, really close friend, was a guy named Hall Caine, Thomas Hall Caine. And Hall Caine was the most famous author of his time, more so than any of the other authors out there. He was one of the richest authors of his time. He sold over 10 million books. Have you ever heard of Hall Caine before? No, probably not. Maybe you have. Maybe you're that well read that you know. I didn't. I don't know. You know how you know of Hall Caine? Because Bram Stoker dedicated Dracula to him, to his friend Hommy Beg, which means little Tommy. Hommy Beg in Manx. Manx, which is a language. So, on the Isle of Manx. So, Hommy Beg, this Hall Caine, was a really huge big deal, gigantic big deal, but he was a very popular author, and he wrote stories about kidnapping and infanticide and men who beat their wives, and that's what the Victorian public was into. Now, we might ask why. Well, the Victorian age was a fascinating age, very much so. Queen Victoria was, of course, Queen Victoria. And the Victorian times were just a wee bit repressed. You know, everything was very proper. Proper, proper. Very, very proper. And I think that when times are repressed, when people are trying to put things down, now Oscar Wilde was during this period of time. And Oscar Wilde and Bram Stoker knew each other. They were buddies. They were friends. And Stoker married a very beautiful woman named Florence. And Florence and Oscar Wilde dated. And this, of course, nowadays we might say, well, did they, you know, how? Because Oscar Wilde was notoriously gay. And as a matter of fact, was arrested for being gay, and imprisoned for it, and sentenced to the treadmill. And basically, they broke him, and he died kind of a broken man. I mean, it was terrible. He was a brilliant wit. He was very funny, very clever. He wrote The Picture of Dorian Gray about the incredible vanity of some of these people in society. If you read it, it's really a remarkable read. It's really a remarkable read about, and when you read it and you're in the know, so to speak, you know, you're in the know, like in The Sting, you know what's going on. It's a little bit terrifying to read the amount of this vanity and this, it's just incredible, you know. But it was all repressed. It was all put it down. And like I said, people were being arrested for this. Arrested and put down and trampled on. And yet it was there. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is another story about the two sides, if you will, where you've got Dr. Henry Jekyll, you know, la-di-da-di-da, you know, I'm a doctor and I'm doctor, and yet Mr. Edward Hyde comes out and he's an animal and he's a murderer, essentially. Same guy, little potion. Woo-woo. What's that potion? It could be gin. It could be rye. It could be something, you know, it's this chemical that he drinks, but in reality, this was very prevalent. Why? Because, well, Victorian society. As a matter of fact, I took a class in college, which was a long time ago. I mean, we're talking decades ago in the 70s, on the Victorian underworld and how horrible it was. I should watch this show Peaky Blinders, because that was a part of it, you know. And one of the things that they really kind of harped on was that for every Victorian man of means, there were like five women of the night. We'll put it that way. For every Victorian male of means, who was a gentleman, and they frequented them. So there were huge numbers of men with incurable diseases and blah, 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 blah. And it was just a horrific sort of thing. But the Victorian underworld was vast. And it was a hypocritical sort of situation. The hypocrisy was massive, you know. By the way, I had a friend of mine, my friend the Druid, who told me what FOP stands for, you see. Hello, Mark. How are you? Mark's in the chat room. How you doing, buddy? It's good to see you. Really good to see you. It's my friend Mark. Mark Husson. He does this too. You should check. He's great. He's an astrologer and so much more. So much more. So FOP, he told me, he said he hated him, just hated him. He says, you know what FOP stands for? He had a really strong Scottish accent. I won't insult the Scots, for it was very strong. And he says, thank you. He said, stands for Friend of Parliament. I said I wouldn't do the accent, but he'd roll those R's. He'd roll them like a barrel on a river, you know, Friend of Parliament. And I said, really, that's what's... He said, yeah, that's what it stands for. So that's what FOP supposedly stood for. But that was the era in which everything was going on. That was the era. That was the entire... It was all about hypocrisy and you know, this staunch, everything was going to ride. So in 1890s, now remember, Jack the Ripper, I found 1898, I think, right? Things were going wrong. Things were going very badly. I mean, things were beginning to go a little astray. Raw. And remember, there was a lot of immigration happening into England. And the immigration was not necessarily welcome. And a lot of them were very ethnic. Let's say that. So, stage is set. What is it about Dracula that has made it so incredibly long-legged? No, that's not the right word. Just legged. I don't know what the word is. But it has lasted over 100 years. 1897, 2025, there are Dracula movies, there was Blackula, the black exploitation, the, you know, just, you know, crazy, what, Dracula from Mars, I mean, what, there was, why? How come it has done so well? When there were lots before, there was Varney the Vampire, which was before Dracula, there was the story of Carmilla, now that was about lesbian vampires, and that was before Dracula. Now, why didn't that last? When it was very erotic. But why didn't that make it? Now, here's why Dracula has. Number one, it's very sexual. And I think that's a big part of Dracula. And I think that's why Dracula has lasted so long without being completely overt, without being over the top overt. It's, if you've read the story, if you've read the book by Bram Stoker, it's extremely, it is. I first read the book when I was 12 years old. It was the first time I was allowed to check it out of the library. If my parents had checked it out for me before, I had to be in the sixth grade, and I wanted to read it when I was about 10, 9, 8, you know, they would not. They said, no, I'm not going to do that for you. So I said, okay, then but as soon as I could check it out myself, and it was as soon as I turned the age, and it was going into, as soon as I got out of the fifth grade, went into the sixth grade, went into the library. My mom drove me to the library. I'll never forget it. I never forgot it. Suddenly I'm Cajun. And I went and checked it out, and my heart was beating because all I knew was movies, you know, movies. And I had just seen, with my friend Stuart at the CSU movie theater, I had just seen The Horrors of Dracula with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, which is a fantastic movie. It's a horror movie, wonderful, and it's a Hammer film. The Brits made some great, great Hammer films. It's the company Hammer. And it's sexy. Christopher Lee, you know, he's 6 foot something, he's tall, and he pulls it off real well, but they have a lot of ladies in negligees, you know, that sort of thing. And I was 12, it was the first Dracula movie I'd ever seen, and, you know, I was like, okay, I kind of get this, you know, this is very cool. But the appeal of it, there's a lot more to it than that, obviously. But there's also more than that. And I'm going to give you some examples. I wrote some things down from the, I'm going to read you. And I think you'll enjoy them. If you've never read the book, you'll enjoy them. If you have read the book, you'll really say, oh, good, I'm glad Mo's going to do this, because you'll know how good they are. They're juicy very much. But there's also some rhetoric in it that you're going to recognize from today, you know, about Ferners. It's kind of amazing what they did. See, now, at the time, in England, there were rich Eastern Europeans coming in to London. And what were they doing? Well, they were buying up properties. That's right. Because they'd kind of taken over, you know, they had farmed out their areas. They'd kind of done what they could do in their parts of the world, and they were no longer really popular, so to speak. And they came into London and they'd bought up properties that were kind of run down. And at first, people said, oh, that's fine. They'll take these properties and they'll clean them up. They'll fix them up. But they didn't do that. They just let them be. They just bought the properties up and didn't do a darn thing with them. They just kind of live there, you know? So that's something that Dracula does. He buys Carfax Abbey, not Carfax like, you know, Carfax. You can find out what your car is doing. That would have been hilarious. But no, that's a good idea, you know? No, I'm not saying. But it's a remarkable thing. So he puts that in the story. And people recognize that. The gypsies protect him. And travelers, they're still part of the English culture today. And they're probably tolerated much better. But at the time, they were still not so happy with them. You know what I mean? Still not 100% beloved. In the old werewolf movies with Lon Chaney Jr., good old Lon Chaney Jr., you know, what a, you know, not the best actor, but he had his dad's name and he loved doing it, I hope he did. But in that movie, it's Maria Ospenskaya, you know, she was a really good actress, but she got into this, she was in that role as the gypsy, the traveler, you know, the Magyar. She's the Magyar fortune. And Bela Lugosi. Ooh. Bela Lugosi, the original movie Dracula. I don't know if he's here. I think he was. He played Dracula on the stage for a long time. And the thing about Lugosi was he was considered to be very handsome and very attractive. Women used to pass out. They'd faint in the audience because they would swoon. They'd swoon because they would be so attracted to Bela, you know, Bela Lugosi. And so he plays her son and he's the werewolf and he bites Lon Chaney Jr. and he becomes the Wolfman, you know. And he's their gypsies and they're, you know, to be feared and, you know, but anyway. So these people are the ones who are present in the story, and they're feared. And he comes to England, and he buys this abbey, and he doesn't fix it up. You know, he probably doesn't pay taxes either. Who knows? But he's really kind of reviled from the very beginning. The whole story is that, and I hope this isn't a spoiler for you, is that Jonathan Harker, the whole thing starts off with Jonathan Harker's journal, written in shorthand, which is, by the way, why I learned shorthand. Because I thought, well, if Jonathan Harker is going to know shorthand, then so am I. And Jonathan Harker, he lives through it. He goes to Castle Dracula, and he's there as a solicitor, as a real estate agent, essentially, to sell this abbey, which, by the way, there's a very strong religious undertow to the story of Dracula. Very strong religious. This ancient abbey, you know how ancient it is, but to this vampire. And wait a minute, you know, we need to talk about something here. Let's talk about the sexual thing for a second, okay? We talk about the allure of Dracula in Bela Lugosi, who was considered to be just this hunky sex pot. Yeah, and you may not see it, you know, but Frank Langella, Flank. You know what I mean. Frank Langella. When he played him back in the 70s, I think he was considered to be a hunk of burning love. You know. Yeah, that's the way I hear him talked about. talked about. That's what I hear him talked about. But I'm not sure that he's... Let me read you Stoker's first description of the Count. Okay? This is Jonathan Harker. He goes into the castle, and he's strong as can be. When he shakes his hand for the first time, it's ice cold. But he says, his face was a very strong aquiline. The high bridge of the thin nose and peculiarly arched nostrils, with lofty domed forehead and hair growing scantily round the temples but profusely everywhere. His eyebrows were very massive, almost meeting over the nose, and with bushy hair that seemed to curl in its own profusion. The mouth, so far as I could see it under the heavy mustache, was fixed and rather cruel-looking, with peculiarly sharp white teeth. These protruded over the lips, whose remarkable ruddiness showed astonishing vitality in a man of his years. For the rest, his ears were pale, and the tops extremely pointed. The chin was broad and strong, and cheeks firm, though thin. The general effect was one of extraordinary pallor. Stick with me. Hitherto, I had noticed the backs of his hands as they lay on his knees in the firelight, and they had seemed rather white and fine, but seeing them now close to me, I could not but notice that they were rather coarse, broad with squat fingers. Strange to say, there were hairs in the center of the palm. Now, hairs in the center of the palm. Now, you and I may say, well, why is that, hairs in the center of the palm? Well, we might say it's because he didn't do anything. He didn't work at all. But at that time, I checked on this. I looked it up because I had that thought. There's an old joke about that. But it was believed that hair grew in the center of people's palms with the practice of what is known as onanism. Onanism. Remember Onan in the Bible? I wrote a limerick about that, but we'll let that go. Once was a fellow named Onan. His sister-in-law caught him groaning. I'll just leave it at that. And so this is a direct point to show that this is about, you know, it's saying that there's something wrong going on here. Now, it's not saying that Dracula did it necessarily, but it points to this kind of ew factor, that these people are impure. There's an impurity to this whole world of vampires, you know. Yeah, he talks about them a little bit more, and this whole thing about the wolves, they're sitting out and they're looking over the valley, and he smiles, and he can see his fangs, you know, and he's just snarling. And the Count, his eyes gleam, and he says, listen to them, the children of the night, what music they make. And he says, ah, sir, you dwellers in the city cannot enter into the feelings of the hunter. I mean, that's pretty wonderful stuff. I mean, Stoker was pretty darn good, you know? And Dracula tells him, don't go anywhere into the castle but your room. I have to go. I've got some things I have to do. Whatever you do, don't go anywhere else. Stay in your room. Don't go wandering around. Don't, you know, it's like a horror movie today, you know. Whatever you do, don't go in that room. So, what Jonathan Harker do? He does exactly what he's told not to do. Now, let's talk about this scene. This is where he meets Dracula's wives. Brides. He's a polygamist, I think. He goes into this room, and it's kind of a bunch of furniture in there, and he gets in there, and he immediately begins to feel kind of tired. He's had a long trip. It's been a long couple of days. Dracula had to leave. Oh, earlier he sees Dracula crawling down out of a window down the castle wall like a lizard. Yeah, pretty cool. And he realizes that he's just suddenly extremely sleepy. So he pulls a couch over and he lies down on the couch and you know, he begins to, me, you know. And he says, I was not alone. The room was the same, unchanged in any way since I came into it. I could see along the floor in the brilliant moonlight my own footsteps marked where I had disturbed the long accumulation of dust. In the moonlight opposite me were three young women, ladies by their dress and manner. I thought at the time that I must be dreaming when I saw them, for through the moonlight was behind them. They threw no shadow on the floor. They came close to me and looked at me for some time and then whispered together. Two were dark and had high aquiline noses like the Count and great dark piercing eyes that seemed to be almost red when contrasted with the pale yellow moon. The other was fair as can be, with great wavy masses of golden hair and eyes like pale sapphires. I seemed somehow to know her face, and to know it in connection with some dreamy fear, but I could not recollect at the moment how or where. All three had brilliant white teeth that shone like pearls against the ruby of their voluptuous lips. There was something about them that made me uneasy, some longing, and at the same time some deadly fear. I felt in my heart a wicked, burning desire that they would kiss me with those red lips. It is not good to note this down, lest some day it should meet Mina's eyes and cause her pain, but it is the truth. They whispered together, and then all three laughed, such a silvery, musical laugh, but as hard as though the sound never could have come through the softness of human lips. It was like the intolerable tingling sweetness of water glasses when played on by a cunning hand. The fair girl shook her head coquettishly, and the other two urged her on. One said, "Go on. You are first, and we shall follow. Yours is the right to begin." The other added, "He is young and strong. There are kisses for us all." I lay quiet, looking out under my eyelashes in the agony of delightful anticipation. The fair girl advanced and bent over me till I could feel the movement of her breath upon me. Sweet it was in one sense, honey sweet, and sent the same tingling through the nerves as her voice, but with a bitter underlying the sweet, a bitter offensiveness as one smells in blood. I was afraid to raise my eyelids, but looked out and saw perfectly under the lashes. The girl went on her knees and bent over me, simply gloating. There was a deliberate voluptuousness which was both thrilling and repulsive, and as she arched her neck, she actually licked her lips like an animal, till I could see in the moonlight the moisture shining on her scarlet lips and on the red tongue as it lapped the white sharp teeth. Lower and lower went her head as the lips went below the range of my mouth and chin and seemed about to fasten on my throat. Then she paused, and I could hear the churning sound of her tongue as it licked her teeth and lips, and could feel the hot breath on my neck. Then the skin of my throat began to tingle as one's flesh does when the hand that is to tickle it approached nearer, nearer. I could feel the soft, shivering touch of the lips on the supersensitive skin of my throat and the hard dents of two sharp teeth just touching and pausing there. I closed my eyes in the languorous ecstasy and waited with beating heart. Far out, huh? Far out. That's pretty hot stuff. 1898. And it doesn't happen, you know. It doesn't happen. Because what happens is Dracula comes in and grabs her by the neck and throws her around across the room to the floor and basically says to them, "How dare you touch him? He's mine." Right? Yeah. It's pretty rough stuff. That's erotic. I was 12. I didn't know what to think of that. I mean, I was 12. The hormones were just kicking in, but I was like, oh my God. Wow. That's amazing. And so from then on, it kind of hit there. Now, Mina Harker, Mina, that he's talking about, is his fiancée. And Winona Ryder has played her. But generally speaking, there's Mina and there's Lucy. Lucy Westenra, who, back in England, along with Mina, they're both always portrayed as extremely attractive. Lucy is blonde, and she's coquettish, and, you know, they're just, yeah. And they're good looking, and they're sexy, and that's part of it. And that's how he plays it, you know. There's always a scene, where, and it's religious too. It's about religion very much so. There is this incredible scene where Dracula takes Mina after he kills. Get this. Let me read this to you first. Because this is amazing. This is so obvious to me. And I imagine it was obvious to the people reading it in 1898. So Lucy, who is going to marry a guy named Arthur Holmwood, he owns a lunatic asylum, you know, as they called it, insane, it's a, you know, where Renfield is, you know, from the old movie. And so Lucy is his fiance. He loves her very much, Arthur, and she dies because Dracula turns her into a vampire. Long story short, she becomes this lady who goes and starts preying on kids in England. After Dracula makes it over to this country, he's a shapeshifter. He can turn into smoke and go underneath doors and stuff. Once he's been invited in, he can turn into a wolf. He can turn into a bat. He can do all sorts of cool things. Pardon me, you know. I mean, Stoker really wrote a heck of a book. If you've never read it, it's once you get past, and Van Helsing is Dutch, so he writes his accent in a very demeaning way. I don't like it. It's hard to put up with because it's really rather demeaning. But there's a little bit of xenophobia there. But that was, people were into it. They were kind of into it. So what they do is they go to, Van Helsing knows it's Lucy. No one else will believe it because they're not even believing the whole vampire thing at this point. So they go to the graveyard. They go and they go to Lucy's tomb. And they're going to go in. He wanted to make sure he gets the right coffin. Listen to this. Van Helsing went about his work systematically, holding his candle so he could read the coffin plates, and so holding it that the sperm dropped in white patches, which congealed as they touched the metal, he made assurance of Lucy's coffin. Another search in his bag, and he took out the turnscrew. Turnscrew is a screwdriver. But why use that term? Holding it that the sperm dropped in white patches. And what he's talking about is a candle. Well, you know, we're talking about candle wax. Maybe there was some from sperm whales, the oil from it. But that's a very specific reference. It's to say that he spoiled Dracula's bride. That's why. Brilliant. Brilliant, 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 brilliant. He really did a good job. The Jewel of the Seven Stars was a sequel. Well, actually, there was a thing called Dracula's what was it called? Dracula's Guest. That's pretty good, but it's kind of unfinished. The Jewel of Seven Stars, he wrote, it was really good until the fact that he died before he was able to finish it, and the ending is not great, because they had to finish it posthumously, his widow did, Florence. Anyway, so back to this idea that there is this, listen to this. So Dracula's explaining, I have to watch my time, but he's explaining, he's hundreds of years old. He's not, you know, I mean, humans are like children to him. They're babies. This is why this endures, because he's not a kid, but he's very wise, because he's been around for hundreds of years. So what he's doing is he's basically saying to Mina after, and they kill Lucy, they stake through the heart. You have to have that scene. You know, it's gruesome, but it's important to say this is how we kill them. And the garlic thing, I think that's in Varney. Is it Varney? I can't remember. But so the whole point is, I was into vampires for quite a while. Had I been the right age, I might have been goth. You know, I might have, you know, I don't think I would have been like that. But I might have gone with the fangs, you know. And when I was a kid, I had paper fangs that I wore, although I really wanted to be more of a werewolf. So here we go. You see, now you know why. But what he does is he opens up his shirt and he takes her and he opens up his chest and he makes her drink his blood. And he says, "You, their best beloved one, are now to me flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood, kin of my kin, my bountiful wine press." Does that sound familiar? It should. "My bountiful wine press." So he gives her blood and calls it wine. This is religious. Now, Bram Stoker, they're pretty sure, was a member of the Golden Dawn. The Golden Dawn being the magical order that Aleister Crowley was a member of, that Aubrey Beardsley was a member of, that a lot of people were members of. They can't prove it 100%, but they're pretty sure he was a member of. A lot of very wealthy people who were, you know, into iconoclastic sort of things, and writing this book would have made him, I think, pretty wealthy, because they also did it as a play, and you know, but he had traveled, and he traveled a lot, and but anyway, so when we look at this, I think one of the reasons why this has been so incredibly popular over the decades, over the century, I mean, it's over a century old, it's almost 120 years old. That's pretty damn good. It's because it is perverse. I mean, in many ways, it really played upon the Victorian mind. It was so sexy and so just, you know, and yet it was kind of underneath the radar in some ways. You see what I mean? And we're kind of in those ages again, if you stop and think about it. Now our horror movies are disturbing to me. You know, there's no nuance. There's no, I mean, there's just slasher stuff. Boy, I tell you what, there was back when I was in high school, a friend and I went to go see Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee. And we decided to do what kids did at that time. At that time, when they decided to prepare for a movie that might be fun to watch, you know. Hey, man, you want to watch this movie? you get my drift? Okay, so we really got really prepared to see Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee, you know? You know, that sort of thing. Yeah, you know. And we were just sitting there minding our own business. And ready to watch Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee, but the first movie was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And we were not prepared for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre at all. Not at all. It was horrific, but we were riveted. I remember about, half an hour into the movie, he turned to me and said, "Let's get out of here." I said, "Yeah, let's leave." But we both just sat there and watched the rest of the movie. And that was just, we were just horrified the whole time. I don't understand slasher movies. I don't like them. The reason Dracula has endured is because it's about us. It's about our psyches. It includes, well, it is sexy. It's as sexy as can be. And it draws us in. And it's about the fact that there are vampires, not in real life. I don't believe in them. Not that type. There are incubi and there are succubi. But that's on a different level. And those are real. The real thing, I believe. But it's a different sort of story. But we know that there are people who are vampiric in that way. They kind of get away from me, We've all known them. But it endures because it's such a... And people, if you've not read the book, it takes a little bit to get into the gothic horror novel. But it takes work. But it's worth it. Because it's a remarkable story. It allows you, and if you're easily influenced and you're very sensitive, maybe it's not for you. But it's a good tale, and it does capture the imagination. And it teaches you a lot about yourself. And about those types of things. But it is erotic at times. And at other times, it's just horrific. And that's what a good tale like that is about. But I think that's why it has lasted, you see. Thank you, Renee. She doesn't like the slasher horror movies either. I don't get it. I don't watch them. I don't want to watch them. I don't like it. We all know that stuff is kind of real, Enough. I mean, I it's too real for me. It's too real. Too real. Too real. Every day, it's too real. Give me the fantasy. Show me Dracula's pointed ears. They don't show that. Show it. Nosferatu did. Do you know that Florence Stoker sued the studio that made Nosferatu and demanded that all the copies be burned, and they had to give them to her. But luckily, they didn't burn them all. And I've seen the movie, and it's a magnificent film. Nosferatu is a good movie. And I'm glad they didn't burn them all. I'm really glad. They didn't ask her permission. They didn't, and it was still, by the way, everything I read you, it's out of copyright. So it was cool. That was cool. So that's that. That's that. It's there's something about that story, just like there's something about Frankenstein, which I'd like to talk about next week, which is actually about the same sort of, it's a different idea completely. Like I said, Mary Shelley was a screaming genius. She was absolutely brilliant. And she was a social reformer, and that's what the story is about. It's not about a monster. Who's the monster in that story? Society. Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein, is, in my opinion, a representation of society as complete and total negligent human being, not doing what he should do. We'll talk about that, because it's something that I still agree with today, that there are those who neglect their responsibilities. It's a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story. It's one that is completely and totally, I don't know if it's heartwarming, but it's a remarkable tale about conscience and a remarkable tale about love and striving for love and parental duty. So we'll take that on next week if I can remember to start the show properly. I can't believe I went all that and then forgot what I was doing. And, you know, so it goes, right? So it goes. I'm such a goof sometimes, but I do what I try to do. I do what I try to do. That's a t-shirt. Okay. Until next week, I wish you all peace and love. Have a good week, and I will, if all goes well, I'll see you next time, okay? All right. Take care, my friends. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Oh, my goodness. All right. Now I have to find, what do I do?
Until next we meet, I'll be waiting for you right here in the Paisley Penny Arcade. 1, 2, 3, 4.